Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. While I was recording this episode, a truly massive and destructive wildfire was burning merely miles from my home. The Park Fire has been both stressful and instructive for me and many others, some who've sadly lost homes, pets, and livelihoods. As we produce this program, the fire's been burning actively in Mill Creek, one of the last bastions for endangered spring run Chinook salmon, steelhead, and wild trout. It's also, or perhaps was, an area containing some of the last remaining old-growth timber in the region. To put some perspective on wildfires in Northern California, we're fortunate to be joined by Zeke Lunder. Zeke is a Northern California native and a fire geographer. He's been much in demand by many media outlets to give his deep insights into the Park Fire specifically and wildfires in general, and he generously agreed to spend time with us. Zeke is the creator and host of the Lookout website and YouTube channel, where he has been using his mapping skills to explain fire behavior. He's also the director of Deer Creek Resources, a firm he started with his wife Erica in 2011 to provide state-of-the-art fire mapping and analysis as well as prescribed burning plans. He grew up in the mountains that have burned during the Dixie Fire in 2021 and the Park Fire now in 2024. He knows this landscape as well as anyone and joins us now with his perspectives. Zeke Lunder, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thanks. Good to be with you, Dave.
You have a really interesting area of expertise. You're an expert on geography and fire. Can you tell me how that came about for you?
Yeah, when I was in school, there was no such thing as pyrogeography, and then I guess they had to invent a title for people like me. Yeah, I grew up in Lassen County in a small town that had a lot of timber and logging and kind of forest management going on, and I came to school at Chico State for graphic design, and after a little while of that, I thought, man, if I keep doing this profession, I'm going to be stuck on a computer all the time, and so I started looking at the catalog, and there was a class that was map and aerial photo interpretation. It was a geography class. And my dad was really into maps, and I kind of grew up with maps around. And I thought, you can take a class on maps. So I took a class and I loved it. And I learned that the geography department had a cartography program that was a lot of graphic design, but also digital mapping. So I got a degree in cartography from Chico State in the mid-90s. And during the summertime, I was working for the Forest Service on a timber marking crew. So we were going around with gallons and gallons of blue paint, and we were painting stripes on trees that were going to be thinned in the forest up around Susanville, Lassen Park. So there was kind of a nexus there. I ended up learning about GIS mapping, which is geographic information systems, and did some of that work with the Forest Service. And that was kind of right when they were starting to take these, computers and map printers out to fire camps to actually make maps for the firefighters. And I came back and worked at Chico State for a while on some watershed projects in Deer Mill, Butte, and Big Chico Creeks. And we were writing existing conditions reports on these foothill watersheds for the Fish and Wildlife Service. And at some point, the guy who was supposed to write the fire and fuels chapter for those documents, he kind of disappeared. And they said, hey, you were on a fire crew, weren't you? And you're going to write the fire chapters. You're going to be the fire planner. And so I started interviewing a lot of old Cal Fire guys and Forest Service people. And then there were some fires here in 99. And because I knew the Cal Fire guys and had already been doing some mapping with them, I got hired to come and make maps of the Butte Lightning Complex in 99 that burned Doe Mill Ridge and Musty Buck and a lot of the areas that burned in the initial phases of this fire. And through that, I met people in Cal Fire who were kind of pioneering the field of fire mapping. And they those connections led me to getting a full-time job the next year with a contractor that was kind of the first contractor doing fire mapping on the West Coast. And I ran their company for 10 years, and we worked on a ton of big fires. And we kind of helped, as a contractor, we helped kind of take this budding field of fire mapping on the road and kind of introduce it to the country. And so a lot of what we helped develop then is now kind of this national standard for how fires get mapped and how they manage all the intelligence that comes in during the firefight. There's this huge amount of scouting and mapping out where things are and mapping out where we think things are going to be. And so the function that we play now, the company I founded, Deer Creek, we still do the fire mapping, and we provide the computers and kind of the network and the hardware and the map printers to for the intel shop that kind of digests all the intelligence on these fires and turns it into daily maps for the firefighters to take out with them in the field.
I'm wondering if you could explain to us the importance of mapping and the digital tools at your disposal now. Why are maps such a great tool for understanding fire behavior?
Well, mapping's always been kind of at the core of coordinating work in the woods. And one old fire person I knew, he said, you have to have a map, even if it's just like drawing in the dust on a hood of your pickup or drawing in the dirt with a stick. Like, that's always been how we, you know, tell people, hey, go down this ridge and take a left at the old snag and whatever. So it's important for establishing a common language of place. And so, you know, we've ended up doing a lot of mapping during prescribed fire trainings. And we train people on how to manage the flow of information about a place. And that starts with developing a common language. And so the map is, it kind of provides a common language of, you know, if you're listening to the radio during a fire, you'll hear people say like, hey, go down to the cattle guard and take a right on that two track. And then when you get down there by the red rock, turn in at that gate where there's a chain across the driveway. It's like, that's all a language of place. And if you live in a place for a long time, you've got that language with your neighbors and you say, oh yeah, go down to the chicken coop and look behind the third rock and that's where the key's hidden or something like that, you know? And so we're always doing that. We're always creating this language of place with people to function in the world. And what's challenging about a fire is that you bring in all these people from outside the area who don't have that shared language. And so the map kind of provides this forum and this placeholder really for us to develop in a hurry a shared language about a place. And then we use that language to communicate and figure out how we're going to operate.
Can you talk a bit about, since you've been started doing this in the late 1990s to now, some of the tools that we have at our disposal from NASA and, you know, the infrared imaging that are newer tools that are really helpful. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, it's interesting that rolling out of new technology has been really slow in the fire industry. Like when I first started, we had these Vietnam era scanners that were loaded in these kind of turboprop planes and they'd fly out of Boise and they had these kind of thermal like fax machine printers and they would fly over the fire and they would scan it and they would take that kind of fax paper roll and they would put it in a plastic tube that had a little beeper in it and a little flashing light because this is at night. And then they'd swoop down over the nearest kind of airfield and they would do a touch and go and they'd drop the tube out of a hole in the floor. And then the infrared interpreter would run out there and they'd find it in the dark with the flashing light and beeper. And they'd take it back and they would kind of eyeball that thermal scan onto topo maps by hand. And they would bring us a sketch on a topo. And then later those folks started digitizing their stuff and giving us a shapefile, a GIS layer basically that we could load in. And so we didn't have to digitize their scratchings. And now basically military technology, military contractors have gotten into the fire management business. For a long time, there just wasn't enough money in the fire suppression industry to justify like the Raytheons and the real big players bringing their toys. It ends up being that it's really expensive to operate a jet engine business jet type plane that can fly at 20,000 feet and bop around. So the money's there now. And so now we have basically they fly the fire and in near real time, they can trace it with these, you know, laser range finders and other cool infrared gadgets, and they can give us a perimeter within a few minutes, and it gets uploaded to a public site, and I can download it into Google Earth, you know, maybe 5 or 10 minutes after it's captured. And so that really just started happening even in like the Dixie Fire, like say 3 or 4 years ago was the first time we were really getting those kind of regular feeds. Before that, we were getting the infrared that was flown out of Boise and they would still interpret it remotely and upload it to a server and we'd have it, you know, a couple of hours after it was flown.
What kind of advantage is it for firefighters and planners to have access to that kind of information now?
Well, the thing about intelligence is that stale intel, it kind of loses its value very rapidly when you're dealing with something like a fire that's moving. And so if your fire is moving, you know, 2 miles an hour and it takes you 2 hours to get a perimeter, then you could be off by 2 miles of where the fire actually is. So now I can be in the field and if I have cell, I can, within 10 minutes, maybe I can upload that new perimeter into Google Earth on my phone and see where the fire is. And the big deal with that is that, you know, there's lots of different ways that the fire ground changes during the course of a fire like this one. Now, if you're on an initial attack fire in the daytime, you can see the fire maybe. And when it gets dark, maybe you don't know the fire is over the next ridge. But like right now, what's happening on this fire, the park fire, is that we've got kind of stable atmosphere and all the smoke is really packed in here in the last couple of days. And so we've been lucky in Chico, you know, the first week of this fire, that the prevailing winds have kept most of the smoke out of the valley. But what often happens is, you know, a fire gets big with unstable atmosphere and good ventilation, and that's why the fire can blow up and create a huge, you know, thunderhead. And that punches all that smoke up into the upper atmosphere, and it kind of gets out of the picture. And so you can wake up in the morning and it'll be clear and you can see where things are. But once the that low pressure kind of moves out and you've got stable high pressure, that can last for weeks sometimes. And all the smoke packs in and we can't see where things are. So I talked to a friend this morning who's up in Antelope Creek, Mill Creek area, with a hotshot crew. And he's trying to figure out where he can safely get his crew down into the bottom of Mill Creek around Black Rock to cut direct can line in this really remote part of the fire. But he can't see the fire. He doesn't know exactly where the fire is. He's way out there without cell and he isn't necessarily getting, you know, the real time intel. But if he's able to get it, then he can see like, oh, the fire hasn't yet crossed Mill Creek. Maybe I've got 5 hours in which I can get my crew safely to the bottom before this thing blows up. So that situational awareness is huge, but we still have kind of the last mile problem of, you know, if you're in the bottom of Mill Creek, it doesn't do any good that the plane goes over every hour. If you don't have that cell connectivity, you aren't going to have that enlightenment.
Are there any possible solutions to that?
Yeah, Starlink. Starlink is starting to be used more by people. They're talking about doing more with IP over radio. So you could, you know, potentially you could put radio repeaters on the air attack planes or other, you know, be transmitting this stuff from a temporary aerial platform. But it's still tricky, you know, and that's, I think that's one of the things that has been tricky about being in fire technology is that there is this real resistance to new technology because no one wants to rely on it too much. Broadband is kind of a finite resource. And so you get out to somewhere like Chester or Westwood or Happy Camp and you already have kind of, you know, like my folks are still on ESL in Westwood. That's like 2 megabits. And there's only so big a pipe coming into that whole area. And so then if you build a fire camp there and you've got 2000 firefighters that are off shift in their tents, watching videos on their phones, you suddenly don't have any broadband. And so that's still a problem. And it's still kind of a limitation that a lot of the developers who are building these tools don't really understand.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with Zeke Lunder as we talk about wildfires in general and the Park Fire, one of the largest in California history, that was burning actively during this interview. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's return now to our visit with fire geographer and host of the Lookout website and YouTube channel, Zeke Lunder. I'd like to use this fire that's going on while we're doing this interview, one of the largest in California history now, the Park Fire, as just a case in point, and explain to our listeners who are, you know, in places all over the world, describe to them how this thing got started and took off to become so huge. Just kind of give us an overview of how that happened.
Yeah, so we're at the northern end of the Sacramento Valley in California, and we have really hot, dry summers here. And so this fire started in late July. And the first 3 weeks of July this year, we didn't have any days where the temperature was under 100 degrees. And we had a lot of days where it was 105 or 108. So it's the hottest three-week period ever recorded in the Central Valley. So being in Chico, right on the northern edge of that, and the region to our north and west is a giant grassland and kind of foothill oak savanna with hardly anyone living there. And the geology here between Chico and Red Bluff is an old volcanic kind of mud flow that is kind of spilled out of the southern edge of the Cascade Mountains and comes down and goes down underneath the valley, the Central Valley. And so it's dissected by all these parallel streams that run perpendicular to the toe of that mud flow. So basically, if you draw a line from Red Bluff to Chico along the toe of the Tuscan Formation, where it goes under the Central Valley sediments, that's Highway 99. And so all the foothill watersheds are oriented kind of perpendicular to Highway 99. So there's hardly any roads. There's only one road that crosses this entire Lassen Foothills landscape of about 1 million acres. And that road is really kind of in poor repair and not drivable by passenger vehicles.
Would that be Ponderosa Way?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very historic, old, old road.
Yeah, and it was built originally by the Civilian Conservation Corps to be a firebreak because it kind of coincides with the transition from the foothill oak woodland and shrub and chaparral to the kind of productive ridgetop timberlands. So basically, we've got 1 million acre kind of landscape here that's this pretty uninhabited. It's one of the least populated areas of Northern California, which is saying a lot because we've got a lot of places like that. But kind of right here, you know, 30 miles from Chico, you can be in the middle of nowhere, like 10 miles from the nearest road. So the alignment of those canyons, we had a kind of a odd southeast wind. And the fire started in Bidwell Park fairly early in the afternoon. And one of the things about fire is that it has different kind of windows of opportunity to become large. But if you look at the kind of entire day, we have kind of what we call the active burning period, which goes from about 2 p.m. till about sundown. And before that, you know, you've got kind of typically the temperature comes down overnight and the humidity comes up and the fine fuels like grasses, they recover some of the moisture that they've lost during the heat of the day. So in the morning, if the humidity is 60%, a lot of the grass, the fuel moisture comes up to a point where it'll barely burn. And it takes a while for the sun to kind of evaporate the moisture out of the dead vegetation. So that early morning period, usually there's kind of a lag before the vegetation is really fully primed to burn. And so in the afternoon, you've got the direct sun, the moisture is gone from the vegetation. We often get some winds in the afternoon. And so we call that the burning period, you know, early afternoon to sundown. And that's the time that fires can spread best. So anytime you've got a fire start that starts, you know, around 2 o'clock, it's kind of a bad thing right off the bat, because it means that the fire potentially has, you know, 6 or 7 hours of active burning available to it. If you have a fire that starts at 10 in the morning, oftentimes you'll put it out because the fuels aren't critically dry. And if you have a fire that starts at 5 p.m., oftentimes it'll only burn for a couple hours before the sun goes down. So that was the first thing that really gave this fire an opportunity, was that it started on a windy day early in the afternoon, and it started in a place where it had access to run up a slope that had wind blowing on it. So we talk about that being alignment, where the slope and wind and fuels and fire location are all kind of in the perfect setup for the fire to run up the hill with the wind at its back. So right off the bat, the fire had an alignment. It ran up out of Bidwell Park. And if you've walked in Bidwell Park and up the North Rim, you know that you can't really like drive a fire engine up the North Rim very fast. And so like maybe 1 mile an hour, 2 miles an hour. So it takes a long time to get, you know, the mile from the North Rim parking lot up to where the fire is. You can't get there in a fire engine in time to catch a fire that started at the bottom and got to the top in 10 minutes. So right off the bat, the firefighters had access issues. They kind of painted the sides of the fire with air tankers, and the fire kind of raced about 1 mile an hour towards Richardson Springs. And what we have around here is this kind of transition that goes from grass and blue oaks to live oak and gray pine. And as you increase in elevation, you get more vegetation. You know, Chico proper only has like 15 inches of rain a year. And Forest Ranch, which is 13 miles up the hill, they have 60 inches. So there's this kind of linear relationship between elevation and precipitation. And that added precipitation causes more soil weathering. And so the soil gets better and better as you get higher and higher up the hill. So by the time the fire was getting towards Richardson Springs, it was getting into heavier vegetation that includes thickets of live oak and gray pine. And the gray pine is a really flammable species. It has a ton of pitch in it, and its needles are highly flammable. And the needles of the gray pine fall. Usually gray pine and live oak kind of coincide in their niche. And also manzanita. So the highly flammable, well aerated mix of pine needles draped in dry brush, it creates this really unique kind of fuel cocktail. And so when the fire got, within about an hour and a half, the fire started to get into these bands of heavy vegetation. And it kind of transitioned from being a fire that was driven by wind in grass under sparse oak to a fire that was driven by heat and long range spotting. So I was watching the fire from up by the Chico Airport, and you could, once it started to hit this bigger vegetation up in Sycamore Creek by Richardson Springs, suddenly you saw the, 200 foot flames and the dark red kind of flames and black smoke. And when that happened, then the fire started spotting, maybe half a mile ahead of itself. And once the fire is driven by long range spotting, it's really almost impossible to control because, you can lay down a line of retardant and a fire spots over it. And then you go and there's three new spots and you attack those, and then the fourth spot gets away from you. And so it became apparent pretty quickly that this fire was going to make a huge run. And it jumped Cohasset Road. And in that first, 5 or 6 hours, it burned about 30,000 acres.
Yeah, it was incredible. Just in the course of a couple of days, it came from basically Chico to my backyard in about a day. It was very alarming. One of the things that I think we need to also talk about, though, on a positive note, is you've described this region as the front country there, where that interface between the valley and the foothills as it goes up into the mountains, the Southern Cascades and the northern part of the Sierra, that fire is, not necessarily a bad thing, that this area probably really did need to burn ecologically. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, if you look at the fire history maps, there's been a really rich fire history in the Lassen foothills. Most of the species out there, the blue oak and the gray pine and the live oak, the brush species, the different ceanothus, they're all adapted to frequent fire, and they're all adapted even to high severity fire. And so blue oak that looked like they were killed after the last park fire we had in, I think, 2021, they'll sprout back from the crowns, and the live oak will sprout back from the base, and the bay will sprout back from the base. And so most of the California species are resilient in the face of fire. And this entire landscape, this Ishii Wilderness and Lassen foothills, almost all of it has kind of got a fire debt at this point, in large part because we've gotten better and better at putting out small fires. These major investments that Cal Fire's made in very large air tankers that can drop 8,000 gallons of retardant, those are really effective in this country when you just have like one fire and it's not critically dry. So as we've gotten better and better at suppression, we've increased the fire debt, I would say, in this landscape. And so we haven't had a large fire in this country since about 1999.
Yeah, it's incredible to think about all the fuel buildup up there. I've been up in that region, and it's just, you could tell it was primed to burn, and here it goes. Okay, so ecologically, though, that region burning is really, in the long run, not a bad thing. But what about the places where above that, where you start to get into the more conifer forests and in those areas managed by like Sierra Pacific Industries, that's kind of a different story up there. Could you describe that for us?
Yeah, I think it'll be useful for your viewers if they are interested in visualizing this, to maybe open up like Google Maps or Google Earth and search for like Butte Meadows or Shingletown. And they will be able to see kind of this really amazing patchwork of clear cuts across the entire kind of midriff of the Sierra Nevada. So Sierra Pacific Industries, they're the largest private landowner, I think, in the country. They have about 2 million acres. They're the largest timber landowner in California. And they're kind of consolidated a lot of the big kind of railroad ownership. So, a lot of the private land that exists in kind of timber country in California and across the West was originally land grants to railroads in payment for them building the railroads. And so they kind of created a checkerboard where every other square mile section along the railroad corridor would be kind of given to the railroad in exchange for building the railroad into the country. And so those ownerships have kind of over years transitioned from companies like Southern Pacific and Burlington Northern and all the big original railroad builders to companies like Georgia Pacific or Louisiana Pacific or Michigan Cal or Weyerhaeuser. So in California, SPI really consolidated a lot of ownership around the time that the Spotted Owl crisis shut down the timber industry on public lands. Red Emerson, who owned SPI, saw the writing on the wall that the logs were going to stop flowing off of the public lands. Back in the 80s, about 50% of the logs that fed mills in Northern California came from public lands and timber sales on the national forest. So when the public lands logging got shut down in the early 90s, Emerson saw that this was happening, and he really leveraged every asset he had, and he bought as much timberland as possible. And so they acquired companies like Michigan Cal and Champion and other major landowners, and became really this kind of the titans of California timber. So that land that they acquired was, for the most part, highly productive. And, you know, some of the best, like Forest Ranch, Antelope Creek, some of these places that have been threatened by this fire or burned, have some of the highest kind of site class, which is the forestry term for kind of soil productivity, anywhere in the world. I think there's a kind of site class one is kind of the highest normal standard. And then they had to kind of create a site class 1A for lands like Paradise and Forest Ranch, because it was kind of off the charts, better than even site class one. So that ownership is, over the course of my career, they wrote a sustained yield plan that was approved by the state to do what they're doing now, that was approved in the kind of mid-90s. And then they started clear cutting. And so their kind of rationale for this transition, before they kind of took over, all of this landscape had been, for the most part, managed with selective logging, where they came in periodically and took, you know, the biggest trees off of each acre and built roads everywhere and had good access. And so they didn't clear cut. And so what SPI inherited, and I think they probably got a pretty good deal on a lot of this land, was a lot of land that had just been kind of loved to death, is what a forester would say. They'd cut all the big trees down, and what was left were trees with forked tops or defects or storm damage or just stunted kind of overcrowded growth because of the competition and lack of fire. And there were also a lot of places where the tan oak and other hardwoods that are less desirable for the timberlands landowner had kind of were there in force. So SPI's strategy was basically, hey, we're going to buy this land, we're going to clear cut it over the next 60 to 80 years, and we're going to replant with the best genetics we can find for each region. So they did SPI. They kind of feel like they're sanitizing this forest that is really substantially degraded by 100 years of high grading. So when you look at that aerial view and you see that this landscape is kind of 50% clear cuts, that's because we're like 30 years into a 60-year rotation. So, you know, 30 years from now, if they still have trees that haven't burnt, their whole landscape will have been cut over once. But that's really what sustained yield forestry looks like, is that you figure out how much you're timber's growing, and you figure out how much, okay, if I'm growing, you know, 600 million board feet across this ownership, I'm going to cut 10 million a year, and that over 60 years, then I'll replace my whole forest. So what that's kind of set up, though, is a landscape that's highly susceptible to fire damage, because young trees are susceptible to being killed by fires. And so if your whole landscape is covered with trees that are, you know, less than 100 feet tall, they're all of them are exposed to being killed by a fire. And what we had here historically before we cut all the big trees down was a landscape dominated by large trees with thick bark and maybe not even any branches for the first 50 feet. And so it's kind of, we can't really go back to that. So SPI is kind of just along, they're along for the ride, but the stage was set for this particular fire, maybe even in like the 1920s, there was a big fire in Antelope Creek in the 1920s that killed a lot of the forest that was there. And even at that time, that fire was probably driven by slash from the first logging. And so a lot of the trees in this area that are burning are all the same age. Maybe the oldest trees are 100 years old.
When they go about replanting these areas that they clear cut, is there a best practice there about the density that you replant those conifers with?
Yes, and that's changed even in the last few years. As kind of a legacy of cut and run forestry, it wasn't uncommon in the past, in the 50s and 60s for someone to buy timberland, cut all the big trees, and then just leave. And so when the California Forest Practice Rules went into effect in the 1970s, they established what were known as stocking standards that said, if you're going to log, you have to replant or ensure natural regeneration to maintain a certain number, a density of trees per acre. And those stocking standards kind of assumed that the people who were planting the trees weren't going to be very good at it. And so they anticipated kind of a high level of mortality. And so as such, the stocking standards were very conservative, and they required foresters to plant a real high number of trees per acre. And I don't know right off the top of my head, but it ends up being like, 12-foot spacing or something like that. So the problem we've had here ever since the forest practice rules were invented is that we've forced the forestry people to replant way more trees than's healthy. And then they've had to come back after, 7 to 15 years to thin these plantations, which is expensive. And then it also creates this problem of what do you do with the slash from, if you go in and cut half or two thirds of the trees down that you planted, that you paid to plant 10 years earlier, then they don't drag all those trees out of the woods. It's not really economical or efficient. So they leave them in the woods. So you've got all these, you've got a period of time in these young stands in the past where there was just all these dead Christmas trees basically laying around in the woods because they had to cut them down to make their forest not completely overgrown and crazy dense. So they changed the stocking standards in the last 5 years, and now they can plant fewer trees per acre. And it means that they don't need to thin as early. And they're becoming more aware too of the losses that are the risk in leaving thinning slash in the woods.
It makes me wonder also when I look at these mega fires like Dixie and now Park, how economically viable into the future forestry is going to be for these companies like Sierra Pacific. Do you think that that's something that, we might see the demise of, companies like that because of this?
Yeah, I think so. Concow is a good example of retreat. And I think, it's useful to think of this issue in terms of climate adaptation. And when we talk about climate adaptation, we talk about, what are your options? You can retreat from the climate challenge. You can build infrastructure, sea dikes or levees. You can move to higher ground, but there aren't that many options. And so I think after the campfire, Sierra Pacific, they bailed out of Concow. They decided they would not replant some of their ownerships in Concow. And basically what was happening there is that in the 90s, they started doing some clear cuts up in Concow. And Concow, back in the 50s, I think had like five or six small sawmills smoking away up there. And so they really, really whacked the old growth in Concow a long time ago. So like a lot of other places SPI is operating, they kind of inherited land that was pretty trashed when they took it over. And so they did some clear cuts and planted up there in the late 90s, early 2000s. And then in 2008, we had the Butte Lightning Complex. And SPI took a lot of losses, both in their forest that hadn't been logged and a lot of the plantations they'd planted, in the 5 or 10 years prior got smoked in 2008. So they did a really thorough job of replanting, including really doing a great job of cleaning up all the slash from the logging of the salvage. So they replanted with fire in mind. They still had to plant at a higher stocking rate because of the laws at that time. But they're definitely, coming into that replanting, they're definitely thinking about future fire losses. But then the 2018 campfire just ravaged all the stuff that either the stuff they hadn't lost in 2008 or the stuff that they had replanted. So after the campfire, they're faced with replanting for a third time. on some of these acreages or walking away. And I think, you know, they saw the writing on the wall that Concow is a place that's always going to have fires and that it was going to be impossible for them to grow trees long enough to harvest them. And so that was kind of, in my experience, kind of one of the first times I'd seen timber company walk away from lands that they manage. And so things like that have an implication if you've got a sustained yield plan that looks at your entire ownership. The trees that they planted in Concow in 2008 to replant before that, those are in their kind of, if you look at a histogram of age class distribution, the whole point of even age management is to have kind of 10,000 acres that are in 10-year-old, and you got 10,000 acres that are 20-year-old, and 10,000 acres that are 30-year-old, and et cetera. So you can cut the 60-year-old trees, and you know that you've got trees 10 years from now, the 50-year-old trees are going to be 60-year-old. And so when you start getting these big events that take out portions of your age classes, you start to get these holes in your histogram, and that's bad news. So, if you burn up a bunch of 30-year-old trees, now you've got a hole 30 years from now in the 60-year-old trees that are going to be available for you to cut and keep your mill running and keep your cash flow going. So these big fires, they put a hit, and they put a hit into that plan. And so what we saw, like with Collins Pine and the Dixie Fire, Collins Pine lost 50,000 acres in the Dixie Fire, and they had to buy 50 or 60,000 acres from adjoining landowner, basically to keep their operation running, to have the logs they needed to run their mill, and just to kind of to fill that gap. So as Sierra Pacific continues to take big hits from fires like this, there's these kind of longer term consequences to a plan they've got in motion that's really a 50 or 60 or 70 year plan.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to fire geographer Zeke Lunder as we discuss the Park Fire and the legacy of forestry practices in California. We'll be right back after a short break. I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our visit with Zeke Lunder. Zeke is a Northern California native, an expert wildfire geographer, and the host of the website and YouTube channel, The Lookout. As somebody who's does the program you do on YouTube, The Lookout, and your website, and does a lot of education about fire and using your mapping skills and geography, you get asked a lot of questions down below, as they say on YouTube. What are some of the biggest misconceptions and things that just people don't understand that you could address here and try to educate people about? No, it's not quite that simple.
I think one of the biggest misconceptions is that if we fail to corral a fire-like park, that there's some sort of rational reason for that, that either someone did something wrong, or like early on in this fire, someone made a comment on my Instagram or on my YouTube saying, this is because the Forest Service doesn't allow dozers in the wilderness, or because you can't use retardant in the wilderness. And at this point, the fire had already, was already done chewing up the issue wilderness and marching on. And so I think there's kind of this misconception that, like, hey, if only we'd had more air tankers available, we would have put this out. Or if only the Forest Service wasn't so lily-livered and willing to fight fire direct, we wouldn't have these huge fires. So there's these misconceptions about kind of the physical reality of what's possible in firefighting, and also kind of the timelines. And I think people don't realize that, like, when this fire ran 30,000 acres in the first day, it opened up 50 miles of perimeter. And then when it was 100,000 acres the next day, it had, 100 miles of perimeter. And that there's kind of this exponential relationship between area and perimeter. And so if you've got a fire that has 100 miles of perimeter and you've got 2,000 firefighters, that's only 20 firefighters per mile. And so there's this enormous amount of work to contain a fire. And so at some point, it doesn't matter how many resources you have available. it's not physically possible to kind of keep ahead of a fire this size that's still spreading.
And I think another aspect of that that you touch on a lot is that, you know, a lot of people, especially if they're not familiar with this area, the topography here is incredibly rugged and steep. Could you talk a bit about how fire responds in topography like we have here in Northern California?
Yeah, well, there's some interesting things it does for the fire effects. And I think it's useful to think about, like, this fire being 400,000 acres. It's got a lot of different unique vegetation types within that perimeter. So you go from, you know, kind of just right down at the base of the valley, it's so harsh and hot and dry that the only thing that can grow is grass. And then you start to get just a little bit of moisture and you have blue oak, and the blue oak kind of creates a little bit different character to the grassland. And then you get a little farther up and you got more moisture and you got live oak, and on and on and on until you get up to, you know, Butte Meadows, and you've got mixed conifer and cedar and Doug fir and ponderosa pine, and you get higher and you're in white fir and you're in red fir. So this terrain that runs through all of this, it kind of compartmentalizes the fire behavior, and it provides for a wide variety of fire effects. So, you know, with fire effects, we kind of talk about the different kinds of fire spread, where you've got head fire is the part of the fire that's most active and burning kind of away from the wind or up the hill. And you've got backing fire, where the fire is kind of moving into the wind slowly or kind of slowly backing down a hill. And then you've got flanking fire, and the flanking fire is kind of moving out to the sides of the fire. And so they, each of those kind of have their own energy output, with the head fire usually being kind of the highest output or the highest intensity. But also, the longer the fire lingers in a place, the kind of the more severe or more impactful its effects are. So we've been doing a lot of prescribed fire in Bidwell Park, burning star thistle. And you kind of develop a firing plan of looking at the wind and the terrain and the fuels, and you figure out, how can we light this fire in a way that is controllable, but also that gives us the fire effects that we want? And so what we found burning star thistle is that if we create like a fire line on the downwind side, and we can light along that, kind of light strips off of that until maybe it's 100 feet wide. So now we've got a fire line and we've got 100 feet of black grass. And at that point, we could go to the other end of the unit and we could just light over there, and we could let a head fire run across the whole thing, and it'll hit our black line and it'll go out. So that's the efficient way to burn it. But if we do that, the fire flashes through the star thistle so quickly that the heat doesn't stay long enough to steam the seeds inside of the seed head. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to get those star thistle seed heads hot enough that it steams and kills the seed. So if we light a backing fire, if we just light at the downwind side and let the fire back slowly into the wind, it takes a lot longer, but the heat lasts longer. And so it backs into the grass falls over, grass stem by grass stem, star thistle plant by star thistle plant, they fall over like little soldiers. And then the fire backs through there and it just slowly cooks through, but you get a lot more heat residence time on those seed heads. And that takes too long. You know, we want to get this done. And the longer that your fire is burning, kind of the more risk that there's going to be a wind or something. So in between is flanking fire, where we might establish a kind of a nice black strip on the downwind side, and then we'll send lighters, maybe walking 50 feet apart from each other, walking straight into the wind, dragging fire behind them. And the fire behind them kind of opens like a zipper. And that flanking fire is kind of just the right amount of residence time to get the project done in a timely fashion. And it gives us more heat residence time than a head fire. So all these kind of, this kind of a great learning laboratory for things like this that happen on the landscape scale.
I'm curious about, we had this huge fire just a few years ago in 2021, the Dixie Fire, which was just truly massive and very similar, has some similarities to this fire. I'm wondering, what are some of the lessons, like for you in particular, that you learned studying the Dixie Fire that you see playing out with this one?
I think the lesson for me, a big lesson with the Dixie Fire, is just that there's these real limits to kind of our Western science approach to understanding potential of fire behavior, and that a lot of the kind of what we consider to be gospel around fire and fuels management really doesn't exist. So we thought that if you thin the forest to a certain spacing, that a surface fire would no longer be able to become a crown fire. And so, you know, before the Dixie Fire, I did a lot of work in the Almanor Basin modeling potential fire behavior with the aim of kind of identifying high priority areas for prescribed fire and thinning. And then when the Dixie Fire happened, like, it didn't behave anything like our modeling said it would. Like, our modeling was basically garbage in that it totally underestimated the potential for massive crown fire run. So, like, what we saw burn around Chester and Juniper Lake during the Dixie Fire, like, there was no way to get the models to predict that. And another thing I think about the Dixie Fire is just that it was such a long, drawn-out affair. And so coming into this fire, there's kind of this part of me that has kind of like got this cautionary feeling that, like, okay, oh, this fire, it's not going to be controlled this week, and it might be burning a month from now. With the Dixie Fire, you know, another similarity is the Dixie Fire took off in the middle of July and grew quickly, and then it kind of laid down for about a week. And then is off to the races again for all of August. So as this fire here is laid down for the last couple of days, I kind of just have this feeling that, like, I'm waiting for the shoe to drop. I'm waiting for that kind of wild frontal passage that where we see this fire, like, burn up and over Turner Mountain in a single day. Subtle changes can have major effects on fire behavior. You know, so, and that's one of the reasons that climate change is impacting fire behavior so much is that, you know, or I'd say less impacting fire behavior and more impacting firefighting techniques. And one of the big lessons from Dixie was that if you don't have cool nighttime temperatures and good relative humidity recoveries, you can't pull off large scale firing operations. And so on this fire, there's been kind of a window of opportunity that arose where Cal Fire's pulled off a really amazing firing operation on Highway 32, basically from where Highway 32 comes out of Deer Creek at the K-Line. They fired from there all the way back to the Butte Meadows turnoff at Lomo. So pretty much the entire Upper Chico Creek watershed as transected by Highway 32, Cal Fire was able to put fire on the ground there for miles and miles and hold it. Huge tactical win. But if we hadn't had a change in the weather and, you know, temperatures have dropped like 20 degrees during that time period, the humidities have been better at night. If we hadn't had that, they wouldn't have been able to hold the fire there. It would have gone right over the top of Colby Mountain and burnt Butte Meadows, and it might, you know, have eventually come back down towards Paradise.
What are some of the things that you most find rewarding about your work on something like this? Because a lot of people look to you for, you know, want to know answers, want to know what the future holds. They want to know if their home's going to be okay. What do you find most rewarding about your work on this?
I think it's the ability or the opportunity to share stories that I've collected over the last 25 years. There's a reason that the company I founded is called Deer Creek GIS. It's because Deer Creek is kind of the central thread through different portions of my life. When I lived in Westwood in Lassen County, or when I went to school in Chico and would drive home on the weekends, or taking my kids up to, you know, the high country, going to Lassen. And I've had a lot of time to experience Deer Creek from a huge variety of perspectives, from satellite imagery, from flying over in a jetliner, from flying over in a little plane or a helicopter, riding a dirt bike, riding a mountain bike, on foot, riding as a passenger in a car, driving in a car. And I think what I learned from that is just that, you know, being a geographer is all about trying to experience the landscape at as many scales as possible. And so all that imagery that I've collected, I'm kind of an archivist. I have imagery that I used in, you know, 1995 on a hard drive. And I've taken thousands of photos. So now that I've got an opportunity to tell stories about this landscape that I know so well, you know, to have a story like this to tell in the heart of my kind of knowledge landscape is great. It's really fulfilling, and it's nice for it to be appreciated. It's nice to hear that other people who have a connection to this landscape really resonate with the stories I'm telling.
Well, Zeke Lender, fire geographer and the head of Deer Creek Resources, we so appreciate your time, and thanks for sharing all your expertise with us. And let's keep our fingers crossed that this fire does not become even worse.
Yeah, and if it does, you can visit the Lookout website and find out what's going on.
Thanks again to our guest, Zeke Lunder, creator and host of the Lookout website and YouTube channel, and the director of Deer Creek Resources. You can learn more by visiting the Lookout website at thelookout.org and deercreekgis.com. In the weeks and months to come, the full scope of the damage done by this fire will be evident. There are places that will benefit from the burn and places that won't. Of particular concern to me is one of my favorite places, Mill Creek, home of some of the last spring run Chinook salmon and steelhead and wild trout, along with some of the last remaining old growth trees in my area. I hope that they survive and will be resilient. And for my friends in Mineral and Mill Creek communities, I so hope your beautiful places will be intact for you to return to and for me to visit, as I have often for so many years. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Cap Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.